Guardian Unlimited.
We first met 30 years ago at Sun Valley, Idaho, at an extraordinary gathering organized by the Levi Strauss Corporation and the National Endowment for the Arts. So it was a conference to consider the theme Western movies, myths, and images. You were there to present the world premiere of The Outlaw Josie Wales. You'd been in the film business then for 20 years, and looking back now over three decades, do you see 1976 as a pivotal year in both the history of the Western and in your own career? Would you have been surprised if someone had said to you then that you would have made 30 more movies in the next 30 years, but only two of them would be Westerns?
You're the first person who has pointed this out to me. I'm surprised about anything, yet I'm not surprised about anything. I remember that conference very well, and I remember there was a lot of people who were no longer with us who were in the Western genre film business, from B-movie actors to moderately well-known character actors, and it was a fascinating time. No, I didn't know then. I did Josie Wales, and then after that I did Pale Rider and Unforgiven. That was it. I guess I would have thought, because I had done quite a few Westerns in the early days, that I might have made a few more, but I kind of got away from it in the later 70s and in the 80s. I kind of got away from it with doing The Escape from Alcatraz and the Every Which Way But Loose and the Bronco Billy, all that kind of thing. I went off in different directions, but I remember in 1980 I read a script called the William Money Killings, which was the working title of Unforgiven, and I thought, gee, this would be a great Western, but I think I should be a little bit older to do it, and I bought the screenplay. It had been optioned by Francis Coppola, and he had never done anything with it. He didn't get it put together for some reason, and so I put it in a bought it and I put it in a drawer, and then all of a sudden in the late about 1990 or 91, I just thought, whatever happened to that? And I don't know why, and I took it out of the drawer and I opened up and read it, and I fell in love with it all over again. And I said, this is nice, and this should be my last Western.
Well, when it opened, the Outlaw Josie Wales, it was considered to be a political film, or at least an allegory about the Vietnam War and its aftermath, presented as about being about the Civil War. How conscious were you at that time of using the Western in that way?
Well, I was conscious of it to the extent that I thought that it was a little different than the Western of some of the Westerns I had done, where the lone person comes to town and gets in conflict and what have you. But there was this tragedy of war from the very beginning, is that the hero was a person who was a fugitive from war and from the tragedy of war, and he. And all he wanted to do was really be left alone, kind of. It seemed like the more he tried to be left alone, the more things came about around him. And as he was destined to be a warrior, whether he liked it or not. I tried to show, even in that film, the sort of futility of it all. And I guess nothing's different today.
John Wayne once said that whenever he received a script that wasn't set in the West, he always tried to imagine what it would be like as a Western. Does that seem overly reductive to you, and how do you react to and evaluate the scripts that you come across?
I just evaluate the scripts and whatever the book or whatever I'm taking the material from. On its merit, I never compare them to a Western. I don't feel I'm married to the genre of the Western. After all, I was brought up in the West, but And I rode some horses when I was young and everything. Maybe I, while I was riding horses as a youngster, my cousin had some horses. I fantasized about the Western, as everybody did. I went to Westerns. I saw the Westerns of Gary Cooper and John Wayne and Randolph Scott and everyone. But I don't think I saw myself as a Western character. And then when I got in the film business, became an actor in the 50s, people kept saying, you know, you could be in Westerns because you're tall in the saddle or whatever, you know, for whatever reason, they were whatever cliches that Western heroes were supposed to be, to look like or be like, slow-talking Jones and all that kind of stuff. But I always thought of myself as a kid who grew up in Oakland, California, for the most part, at least through my later teenage years. But I like stories basic. When I see a story, I just, very simplistic. Is this something I'd like to be in? Is this something I'd like to see? And if I'd like to see it, would I like to tell it? Now, as in senior years, I look at it more from a directorial standpoint. I suppose in the early days, I would have looked at a film project like Million Dollar Baby as, is this something I'd like to be in, and would I like to direct it? I think when Million Dollar Baby, I probably said, is this something I'd like to direct, and would I like to be in it? So things have probably changed a little bit in that sense most of the time, because I had just finished Mystic River, so I was mostly interested in moving behind the camera, figuring that my retirement would be rather gradual. And then someday they'll say, get out from behind the camera and I'll go into the sunset. But right now I've been enjoying things the way they are. But I don't know how I evaluate it. I never evaluate anything to the Western, unless I see a Western. If somebody... Westerns to me have to pop. And Josie Wales kind of popped off the screen. It was a book. Forrest Carter sent the book on a speculative thing. He mailed it to a lot of people. He mailed it to Robert Mitchum and Burt Reynolds and many, many people in Hollywood. He sort of hoping somebody would grab it. And an associate of mine, Bob Daly, who was working for me at the time, he read it and said, gee, I really like this story. So I read it the next night. It was so easy to read. You could read it in one sitting. And I said, yeah, I want to do this. I knew right away I wanted to do it. And I knew right away I wanted to do Unforgiven. You know about stories. Sometimes you revisit them and you think about it. In The Line of Fire, I had to think about that. They wanted me to direct that too, but I didn't want to do it because I had just done Unforgiven, and I felt I needed a little bit of time off in between, and so we got Wolfgang to come over and do it, and he did a very nice job.
How did you come across Bradley's Flags of Our Fathers? It's one, if I'm not mistaken, one of the only two non-fiction sources for a film of yours, the other being Bird. How did it come your way? And obviously it wasn't a film you see yourself as being in.
Well, a friend of mine is the owner and publisher of the Carmel Pinecone. It's a local newspaper there in the Monterey Peninsula. And he called me up one day and said, have you read this book, Flags of Our Fathers? And I said, no, I hadn't. And he said, well, it's an interesting book. He says, you ought to read it. And I said, well, I'll go get it. And I'll go get it. Thanks very much. And when I came out of the house some hours later, it was sitting on my mailbox. He left off his copy there. So I started reading it, and I found it very, very interesting and found it a good read. I found it in a true story, non-fictional way, what we had done in Bridges of Madison County, in a fictional way of having the child find out about their parents after they had passed away. And that was interesting because I'd already portrayed that as in Madison County. And now we were here was a story, a true story of a guy who didn't really know what his father did. And the mystery, of course, is why didn't his father ever confide in him about the story? And then we find it's the experience of war and the guilt of false heroism and all kinds of stuff that made him be somewhat of a recluse. So I became fascinated by that. And so I tried to buy the book, and it had already been bought by DreamWorks. And so I thought, well, Steven Spielberg he's got some plans for this property, what have you. And I didn't think too much about it. And then a couple years after that, I was at an event, and Steven came up to me and said, have you ever read Flags of Our Fathers? And I said, yes, I have. And he said, how do you feel about it? I said, I like it very much. I've always liked the book. He said, well, would you consider coming over to our company and running with it, but take it over and direct it? And I said, okay. And the conversation was just that long. I shook hands, and that was it. He had had some screenwriters work with it, but he had never got it to his satisfaction. So he suggested not looking at any of the material that was there and just bringing somebody else in. So I said, well, I'm working with a writer right now on Million Dollar Baby, who I like very much, Paul Haggis. I think he's very clever. I said, maybe I could get him, talk him into taking a crack at it. And so we did. And then while that happened, I got curious about the plight of and the type of people that the defenders were. And then one thing led to another. And I went to, after going to Iwo Jima and looking over the island, I started looking at it from both points of views and how miserable it was for both sides. And I figured, well, maybe I'll tell both stories and see.
The emotive word, father, in the title, was that important to you personally, that in regard to the generation before you, particularly the generation of your own father and what they went through in the Depression and World War II, which as a result of almost the dropping of the atomic bomb let off you and me and a number of other people from actually going into World War II.
Yeah, I think the fathers, you always think of what your father did beforehand as young men. My father wasn't in the military, but everybody else, the great majority of people were at that particular time, and we had just barely come out of the Depression, and then we started into a war. So it was an interesting time in history. I think consequently, because we'd just come out of the Depression and went into war, is what made America such a good fighting force, because they were a bunch of skinny kids off of farms and out of cities and what have you, and they weren't going to have any of this being attacked.
Much of your a work over some sort of 50 years has been in genre movies, westerns, mm-hmm. Thrillers, a touch of science fiction, and you were sort of, at the time when you first became a major star, appeared in two World War II adventure yarns of action movies, and Red Eagle's Dare and Kelly's Heroes. Do you think that the war movie is a genre, and is it a legitimate genre?
It might be a genre. Yeah, it might be, but I didn't approach these pictures as genre. I didn't feel these pictures fit a genre, and maybe I didn't feel that war movies should fit a genre, because I was just interested in telling humanity stories and human experience stories, and not necessarily the heroics of war or charging over the hill with the banners and what have you. I guess I grew up like every little kid. You grow up playing war and shooting and doing all those things. You're playing cowboys at war. And you're always, there's always got some sort of a conflict. And mankind is sometimes is most creative at war, which is a sad thing in a way, but it's sometimes when you think of, you look at war equipment and everything, and you think of how inventive mankind can be to find ways of destroying one another. It's that sort of brought me an interest, at least at this point in my life, into the futility of it all and the insanity of it all. But there it is. It's been with us for thousands of years, and will probably be there for thousands more.
Did you see or think while you were preparing and making Flags of Our Fathers, did you recall or notice any the thing that Heartbreak Ridge had in common with the later film? That in Heartbreak Ridge, you have this Marine sergeant, Tom Highway. He has been traumatized by the war in Korea. The film opens in black and white with newsreel film, and then jumps 30 years later to him. And he is, I think the first time you see him in the film, he is drunk and in jail, and you realize that he is somehow lost. But the thing he clings on to is the family, which is the Marine Corps. Now, doesn't this in some ways anticipate the character of Ira Hayes, one of the people who raised the flag on Iwo Jima, finding a home in the Marine Corps and then being sort of bereft after he's left it?
Well, yeah, you bring up a very interesting point. Yeah, there is a certain similarity there in a fictional way as what happened to Ira Hayes in a factual way. Yeah, the thing that was interesting to me about Heartbreak Ridge was not it was completely different than what I'm into now, but at the same token, it was about the lost feeling, about a man who had been for many years in defense of his country at the beck and call of his country, but actually didn't know much about his country, didn't know much about his own relationships with his wife. He had sort of let everything else in life fall to the wayside for being a soldier of his country, and that the Marine Corps became his life, and then here he is facing retirement or facing his senior years in not understanding anything about her or anything about anything except just Marine Corps drill. And he's starting to philosophize now in a different way and try to find himself. And I guess Ira Hayes could be something like that, as it had been tough on him. I think not only the war part, but I think because probably his life in the Marine Corps was the high point of his life. Probably he had the most family there in his unit, in the esprit de corps of the unit and everything. The disappointments of being treated and wined and dined and being the true American Indian, being a glorified through this whole bond drive, and then all of a sudden going back to the fields of the Pima Nation in Arizona, it was just a constant descending thing.
Because the film has revived What was sort of 30 years ago, the idea of the tragic hero of Ira Hayes. There was the Johnny Cash song and a couple of other films.
Right.
Suddenly he's been forgotten, and you've revived interest in a very important figure of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was an interesting story. I thought it was interesting, Ira Hayes, because of this whole short life he had. So many things had happened to him. It's sort of a sad thing when somebody who's been such a figure in people's mind, especially, you know, they go out and these boys are somewhat responsible, or at least the myth of building them into heroes is responsible for raising $28 billion, the largest fundraiser ever, even to today's standards. You know, $28 billion today would really be something. But they had such great importance for the war effort, and then of course they're just left to go. And John Bradley seemed to be able to pull it together because he had some knowledge of being a funeral director, and the other two just kind of wandered. I guess that's something to be said. I mean, probably many instances in the American experience like this, but Ira Hayes certainly depicted it in a very strong way.
At what point did the idea of making two movies, one from the American point of view, one from the Japanese, as a sort of complementary diptych of a film, at what point did this emerge? And was Steven Spielberg immediately sort of responsive to the suggestion of two films being made?
The idea occurred while we were preparing. Well, I was talking with Paul Haggis about the screenplay and the writing and a meeting between Spielberg, Haggis, and myself. And we were talking, philosophizing about the screenplay and how it should be done. And Haggis was telling us he thought maybe he could do it, but he'd take a crack at it, but he wasn't sure which way to go with it. And we later philosophized on it and kind of ended up where we ended up. But at that point, after I'd been to Iwo Jima, I said it early in the game, I wanted to go out there and take a look at the island and see the feasibility. Is it feasible to go there and film there? Would it be feasible? Because it had been given back to the Japanese in the mid-60s. I just didn't know what to expect. So we went and visited with the governor of Tokyo, who Iwo Jima comes under his jurisdiction, and he gave us approval to go out and looked at the island and feel the history of the island, feel how it's like for the Marines to come in that deep black sand and with 100 pounds on your back and try to climb up through that with people shooting at you, throwing all kinds of ordnance at you. And at that point, I started thinking, what it was like to also be, what was it like for the defenders? Because nobody could see the defenders, they were hidden. Climbed in the caves and myself and went down in the caves and climbed through little tunnels, no bigger around than the black part of that fireplace, to into Kurabayashi's headquarters. And so I became interested, what's Kurabayashi like? And what are these guys like? And just one thing led to another, and I started thinking, I wonder what their life was like, what they were thinking. And I started reading material on Kurabayashi, and then I kind of went from there to and Iris Yamashita, who we got to write the screenplay. She researched and found Baron Nishi and all these fascinating people that had also been to America and lived in America for a spell, and had friends in America, and there, but for just the small changes in political structure, are people who could be friendly with one another. And Kiribati had the same feelings of concerns about his daughter and his son's well-being and his wife's well-being while he was gone as an envoy in the United States in 1928, 1930. What's so different about him than every other father in every other country and every other society? And really nothing. And that and plus reading about Iwo, General Holland Smith said that he felt that the smartest general on the island was Kiribati, and he was paying tribute to him in a left-handed sense, sort of saying that the defense of the island was so unique that it caused the battle to go on for over a month as opposed to 3 or 4 days, which they were hoping it would. So that all became very interesting to me, and all of a sudden it became a rich story that would not only be different, but it would give us some of the commonality between young people being sent off to war, regardless of what society they're in, what culture they're from.
Unlike sort of earlier films that have tried to look at a particular event in war from both sides, like Toro 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 and uh-huh. The Longest Day, you've actually made two very different movies about kind of different experiences. One is about sort of a tale of horrendous sacrifice, but which was part of a victory in a just war, as it was considered at the time, and is by most people still considered. And the other film is a tragic story of defeat and about the destruction of a culture. Did you see this when you were conceiving the movies?
I saw the possibilities of this. I don't think I'd have been interested in doing a Toro 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 style story, because Toro Toro Toro, you're just doing little snippets of both sides. I felt I would rather indulge both sides. To me, I wanted to tell full separate stories and do, like you said, analyze what it is, a defeated a group of people on the last elements of a certain mentality, a certain type of culture, as the Americans, like maybe the last just war. I mean, maybe, I don't know if, I'm sure people enter wars thinking they're just and have a million great reasons for going. They can rationalize in their own mind. But World War II, of course, was all the great unification of people, because being attacked by the Japanese and at Pearl Harbor sort of changed America's mentality. There was a great division in the country then about isolationism and shouldn't be bothering about the European war, that's somebody else's problem, and as opposed to the other group that said, yes, we should be helping them out and coming to their aid. Those were philosophical splits of that time, and here and there we are. We go off into Korea, as it's a police action, and it wasn't called a war. And then Vietnam and everything. But I guess World War II is the last war we really wanted to win.
In making a sort of a revisionist picture, do you think you've perhaps been harder on your own country than on the Japanese? That there was nobody at the higher ranks in the command positions in the in Flags of Our Fathers who has the equivalent stature, or is as sympathetic or as heroic in the largest sense of the commander of Iwo Jima and his chief officer and lieutenant, the equestrian champion. Do you think film could be seen as well as almost as sort of unbalanced in that sense? I wouldn't say that, but you have people ever said that to you?
No, I don't think so, because they're just different. I wouldn't call them unbalanced. I believe that the American hierarchy, as portrayed in Flags of Our Fathers, was not portrayed in a bad way. Certainly, we have the Treasury Department person, Gerber is the character, who's thinking up this whole idea of the fundraising. But he's got a very strong point of view, and he's right. I mean, he had to do something. They're desperate measures, and in his deal, I mean, they were in their zeal to get a great fundraising gimmick, of which was very clever. They overlooked some of the accuracies. In other words, when the fellas tried to tell them that you may be crediting somebody else for being there who wasn't there, and their mother's going to be invited to this thing and treated like a special thing, and somebody else is going to be left out. They just said, well, we can't worry about that. It's too bad that mistake's been made. We'll just kind of go on. But you can see the urgency because of the wartime mentality. But at the same token, you can see the sort of the sadness in it, the mass confusion of it all. But yeah, there is no. We're not showing any general. We're not showing the story of MacArthur or any of the generals or admirals of the Pacific War. But with Kiribayashi, we're sort of seeing him through the eyes of a conscriptee, and we're sort of seeing the. I don't think there's a balance. I think they're just different. I don't think there's a lack of balance there, to answer the question properly. It's just different. It's different. So I suppose you could have told the Flags of Our Fathers from the point of a military commander, and that would have been different. But these pictures are more or less about the common man. And the common man is required to, as with an average age of 19, to go aboard and do all this stuff. And I'm sure the Japanese average age was similar, if not younger. And it meant to be about them. But the same token, it does focus on Kiribayashi as leadership abilities, because that story is based upon the genius of the tactical defense, and where the American defense's attack is the invasion, the Japanese thing is a guy who's taking an impossible situation and making it more difficult than it should be. Normally,
I think most people coming out of both films we'll see in Letters from Iwo Jima the dominant figure being General Kiribayashi, the commander of Iwo Jima, and of Flags of Our Fathers being Ira Hayes. And they're both men of great honor who actually then had to sort of choose between a devotion to their comrades and duty and protesting against rebelling against authority. Do you see them as carrying on a tradition of such figures in your work, that were for defiant rebel figures who recur, like, I mean, in its most extreme form, someone like Frank Morris in Escape from Alcatraz, but also the people who are somehow are outsiders trying to deal with their place in society?
I think they're somewhat outsiders. Even General Kiribayashi, though he isn't on the same thing as Frank Morris or Ira Hayes, who are outsiders as more common men, he's a man of authority But he did live in America, studied English in America, traveled extensively in the 20s and early 30s, and liked America, and liked people, some of the people that he'd met, and he was against going to war with America. He thought it was a very impractical thing to do. He thought the military complex was way too large, and that the Japanese ambition to invade America was absolute insanity. So he makes for an interesting character in the sense that he's not the conventional military leader of Japan at that time, who said, yeah, we can do it, you know, and we'll go and we'll be an expansionist. We'll follow suit like we've been doing in Asia and everything else in, over the last several decades. So he's a little bit of an outsider that way, and he's an outsider right up through his tactical things to make things to dig into the island and make the whole defense a whole different deal rather than the norm of the Pacific Islands that had been where the Japanese just defended at the beaches and until they're wiped out, and then the next battle goes on.
The framing device of letters from Iwo Jima is you don't immediately realize what's happening. Something being dug up, something being disinterred. Mm-hmm. At the end, you discover that these are the letters that were to be sent home and are discovered. Can this also be seen? We intended this to be a sort of symbol that you were the past was being buried and is being disinterred for a new generation to re-examine it.
Yes, it could be, because that's sort of what the picture is all about. It's sort of presenting something to the new generation. The one of the ironies in making this film was when I went to Japan, was that besides Ishihara trying to convince him what I was going to do, because I think at first he was kind of going, you know, is telling this, bringing this story that no Japanese studied in school or they have no history, not great volumes had been written about it, and most of the veterans of Iwo Jima were just like Bradley, only more so. They just didn't talk about it. They just went into their whatever their lives were. I imagine there's some great stories about those veterans. I never had the pleasure of meeting any of them because we couldn't find any of them that we really wanted to talk about it. There was one fellow who's written some articles recently that has written some interesting stories about it. And that's where we got all the information about how they buried themselves among the dismembered bodies and all that sort of thing, which is what actually happened in order to stay hidden. And how you can wallow in the absolutely most disgusting things in the world in order to stay in existence. But yeah, it's for a new generation to look at, and it's for to pay him a tribute to. That doesn't mean that I think the war should come out any different. I just think that you're rooting for them in the sense that you're rooting for them to live and go home and have a life. You're not rooting for the war to come out any different. You're rooting for the Americans to take the island. But you're hoping that these people would, that you meet, you get to like them or know them well enough that you'll wish that they could go home and just have a normal existence.
Is there anything that has particularly surprised you or particularly pleased you about the response that you've had to the two movies in both Japan and in America?
I think that the Japanese movie, the response has been really good in Japan, really good. I didn't know what it was going to be, to tell you the truth. I didn't, you know, it's a little bit different for the Japanese to have some gringo come in there and have say, well, he's going to tell some story that we don't even know about or have heard very little of. And or for some of the older generations that has stayed buried. But the men of the Iwo Jima Association, I think they were glad to see some tribute being paid to the 21,000 men who were buried, maybe 12 or 8,000 that's still interned in the island with no identification possible. And I think that they're looking for some closure there. And I think that's from the letters I've gotten from prime ministers and various people that there seems to be an appreciation there.
When you were making Letters from Iwo Jima, did you think that you were not making an American film, but actually making a Japanese movie? And were you, in fact, influenced by your experience on the set of the films with Sergio Leone, where the director spoke a different language from many of the people in the movie and had to communicate in different non-verbal ways or through translators? I don't speak a word of Japanese or very little. Sergio spoke no English.
None at that time, yeah. I felt I was making a Japanese movie, yes. I didn't feel I was making it in a Japanese style particularly, but I was like some of samurai movies and what have you. I just approached it like I was telling a Japanese story with Japanese people, and I didn't think of it in terms of American movie. I always thought of, here's what we're doing story-wise, and I wasn't taking sides in it, really. I was just showing the plight of these people. What was the second part you were talking about then?
Yes.
Leone.
Yes.
Yes. The Sergio Leone pictures didn't have much relative to this story, but yes, working in other languages did. Yes, Sergio had that same obstacle with me. I was didn't speak Italian at all at that time, and he didn't speak English at all at that time. We had to communicate through interpreters and stuff, and it worked out okay. And it worked out good with us. We had interpreters on this particular picture. We had four interpreters all the time because the Japanese actors, very few of them spoke English. Ken Watanabe is a little, and some of them spoke English a little bit, but most of them were not very comfortable in the language, even the ones who spoke some English. But it was doable. And the thing we had to overcome here, that Sergio didn't have to come, is we had to tell this story in the dialect of 65 years ago, which is a different Japanese dialect than they use now, and a lot of different vocabulary. A lot of words have changed, so we had to be aware of that too. And that we had a few actors, older Japanese actors, who knew of the older style, and so we were kind of aware of that. So not only am I doing it with a language I don't know, I'm doing it with a dialect that I've never heard of. But I tried to do all that, and when even down to when we recorded the kids, because that was a real instance where they made this live radio broadcast and sung this song for the men on Iwo Jima, and that we had to make sure that the kids learned the dialect. So it was somewhat tricky, but we did that, and then we could then to find that song was difficult because it had never been recorded. It had only been sent out over the airwaves at that time. So we, But somebody had recorded the music of it, the theme of it, and the lyrics. So I had the song and the lyrics and the music, which somebody had played on an organ or something. And so we started from scratch, and we recorded some of them in the States and some of them in Japan and put it all together.
Talking of Sergio Leone, have you ever thought that his career after you went your different ways has followed a not dissimilar one to yours? He went on to make an epic American crime movie, Once Upon a Time in America, and for his last 10 years of his career he was working on but never realized his great war project of looking at the siege of Leningrad from both sides. Uh-huh. Did he ever talk to you about that film?
No, I had heard he was talking about doing a Leningrad story. He had mentioned things about that, but he had never mentioned detail. He never said he had a story. Never had the thing that always surprised me about Sergio, because I liked him and liked working with him, but he wasn't very prolific. I was surprised that he didn't go and do a lot more material. It seemed like most directors that he admired from earlier years were all people who were very prolific and made tons of films, and directors of the 40s and John Ford and people that would make sometimes a couple films a year and just go from one to another. But Sergio never was. He had this, I remember he talked about Once Upon a Time in America while we were shooting The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Even back when he did For a Few Dollars More, he was talking about, he had this thing about doing he wanted to do a gangster movie, a mafia movie, and then he thought, well, he talked to me about it, being in it, and said, we'll make it an Irish mob kind of thing like that. And at that time I enjoyed working on with The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, but I was definitely starting to feel that it was time for me to move on and make some American movies and some movies of different genre. I had done the three Westerns, and they had made an impact, but at the same token, I guess subconsciously I wanted to move on and do something entirely different. I don't know what it was, and eventually it all came along. I think over a period of years, I did enough different things till finally you break through in other areas and go on to... I was constantly in motion. My mind was constantly in motion. His, for some reason, he got into this thing about Leningrad and never went beyond that. And I always wondered why, because he seemed like he loved to be shooting films, but he just, maybe his decision-making process was difficult, or he never found anything that really clicked for him, I don't know.
What is it that drives you on? You may have been involved in as director, producer, actor in over 60 movies in the last 40, 50 years. And yet, there are contemporaries like Warren Beatty, who make one film every 5 or 6 years, and Terrence Malick, who makes one film every 15 years. What drives you on? Is it the fun of making movies? Is it the constant work ethic?
I think it's just work ethic. It just becomes part of my life. And if I have any virtues, which are probably not very many, I get fairly decisive about things. When I find something I like, I usually know it pretty soon. I don't have to talk myself into much. And so I probably shoot from the hip a little more than Warren Beatty or other people. I don't know how they think, but they probably just ponder things a little more, and I probably just say, yeah, I like this, let's go. I don't sit and have to dwell on it too much. I dwell on it as I make it. I mean, the making process is dwelling for me, where some people have to dwell long beforehand before they pull the trigger on the actual filming. So I can't speak for anyone else. I guess everybody's just a little different. And I know Warren got up at the Golden Globes and went on about Clint. He says, "How do you do that? I mean, the two pictures in 1 year and all that." But you know, when I grew up, I mean, Howard Hawks and Raoul Walsh and all these directors that I grew up with, they made several pictures in 1 year. It was no big deal. But nowadays, everybody makes a deal that you can't do it. I mean, it's an impossible feat. It wasn't an impossible feat. Some of those B-movie guys that did assignment, they'd get the script on Friday night and say, "Monday morning, you're starting with this, and here's your cast." And you'd go, I guess they just went. They just kind of went with it. I mean, it is amazing, and they became great directors because of it, I think. Even if some of the pictures didn't work, or they were miscast, or something went wrong, it made for a great work ethic because they were just constantly directing. And it's like a musician. If you play every day, your embouchure is strong and everything. If you play once every 2 years, you have to build up all over again.
Which of the directors from the so-called golden age of Hollywood, from the late 20s up until the sort of 50s, 60s, which of them would you most like to have worked with and regret not having worked with?
At that time in my life, when I first came in the business in the 50s, of course, a lot of those people were starting to retire, and I would like to have worked with an awful lot of them. I knew Billy Wilder. I knew him socially. Would love to have worked with him. I did work with Bill Wellman as the only one of those kind of classic people.
On Lafayette Escudero.
Yes, I worked briefly in that. I was in it for a couple weeks' work, but I got to observe and watch him. Knew his family a little bit, liked them. I would have liked to have worked with Mr. Hawks and Mr. Walsh, Preston Sturges. I liked him a lot. I talked to Alfred Hitchcock once about working with him. He had a screenplay in mind that he wanted me for, but he wasn't. It was long after he was really doing it. He was kind of just in retirement. And we talked about it, and they asked me if I'd meet with him, and I said, sure. I said, but when's he want to do this? And they said, well, he's probably not going to do the picture. And I said, what do you mean? Why are you leading him on to think he's going to do the picture and you want me to go meet? I mean, I love to meet with him because he's a classic character, but they said, well, he's just at that stage where he's not physically up to it now. And I said, oh, okay. Well, I'd love to go meet with him. So I did. And that was great fun. But I'd like to have worked with any of those people. Working with Don Siegel was close to that because he had worked for so many of those people as second unit directors and what have you. And working with him and people who had done some of the great B-movies of that era, I learned what it's like to make something out of nothing. In other words, he could make things, he could put together a scene in a room like this in 15, 20 minutes and have and progress on with it, rather than do, like you were saying earlier, be one of those guys who had to ponder about it for years. What happens if everybody who did that was just forced to go do something? Say, okay, here's the scene, here's the thing, here's your actors, go ahead, put it together. That would be a good work ethic. And that would be something that would be a great lesson for people in life because and maybe that's why some of those films were so good in that era, because people were forced to make things happen. And they were in the job, and if they weren't there, somebody else would do it. And the Jack L. Warner and those Harry Cohn and all these Daryl Zanucks, they just said, you know, get out and do it. They didn't. Don used to love to tell the story. He said, well, you do this picture, and Jack Warner was saying something to him, and he told Jack Warner, he said, you know, it's just difficult. And John Warner looked at him and said, when's it not difficult? And he says, get out there and do it. And he said, he learned something about it. Because I've heard him quote that quote many times, he said, yeah, he's right. What am I sitting here feeling sorry for myself for? I'm directing films, I'm doing things I want to do. I shouldn't be complaining.
But Don Siegel worked more often than not, because he had to, given the budgets he had. He could make a film in two weeks and less in some cases. But you like to work fast, but that I've understood is because you you don't want to waste money on one hand, but you also you get a freshness by having people not expect to do 37 takes, you know, as Bill
had it. Well, I learned. I've sort of had that feeling myself, but I learned. I did, because I started out on B movies myself. Mm-hmm. I was at Universal. In the days they were only making kind of B movies, and I worked in the pictures with Jack Arnold and Tarantula and all these Never Say Goodbye and all these crazy movies. They weren't really none of the movies of Clark Gable or Gary Cooper or whomever. I was in none of those. But I saw how directors worked and how some of them worked very fast and. And even Bill Wellman, I was fast. They were all fast. They you know, maybe George Stevens, some of them were slow and did a lot of takes. But the thing that Don always said is that he's always trying for it. He's trying at the beginning. And I said, yeah, I know that. As from an actor's point of view, when they're always trying for it, then everybody else is trying for it. If you know that the director's not going to print anything till maybe the eighth time, the first seven times you're kind of coasting along, going, okay, well, I'll save the money, and you go, I'll walk over here and I'll do this, but if somebody says, you might print that, you get up and go, okay, I'm walking over there, and the dialogue's coming out like it's the first time you've ever said it, and that's what an actor strives for, is it should sound. To the audience, it should be like, this is the first time these lines have ever been said, and the first time this thought has ever transmitted through your brain, and that's the ultimate. Now, that doesn't always work. Sometimes there's technical reasons. You have to do a scene multiple times because you're doing different angles of the scene, but that all comes. But sometimes that first moment is magic, and I've watched directors go and have a really great moment and then maybe do 10 takes afterwards to try to recapture it and never recapture it.
There seems to be a lot of quiet subversion in your movies. The historical revisionism, challenging the conventions of the Western, most especially in The Unforgiven, treatment of euthanasia in Million Dollar Baby, not having a debate about it, but having a hero who believes it is the right thing to do and carrying it out. Do you think, are you able, as it were, to get away with it or to put these ideas across because you're regarded as perceived as a conservative or a man of the right, a person of the right of a rather traditional sort of dedicated American sort of.
I don't know. I don't know. I heard people criticize who hadn't even seen Million Dollar Baby say, you know, I've heard people say, oh yeah, he's done this thing about euthanasia, and they get all upset. Some right wing radio personality or something, and I. wait a second. First, my first question is, have you seen the picture? And do you, are you interested in the people? Are you interested in the plight of a man who's never had a relationship with the daughter that he wanted to have a relationship with? There's been something in their history that has been negative, and he finally finds a surrogate daughter that he loves desperately, and then loses her. The circumstances, do they really analyze the circumstances? No, they don't, and so they make a critical judgment. But if you really analyze the circumstance, then you think, it becomes an interesting challenge. I don't know if I'm allowed to, because I'm not really a conservative as much as I am. I'm conservative on certain things. I believe in less government. I believe in fiscal responsibility, and all those things that maybe Republicans used to believe in but don't anymore. And so consequently, I think the differences in my country anyway, the differences in the parties is no difference. There's just a lot of people trying to keep their job. And so I'm a little bit cynical in that aspect of But I think I can make them, just because I do them boldly, because I'm at an age where, what can they do to me? Once you pass 70, it's what the hell can they do to you? You know, so it's kind of just a situation you get into where you just go ahead and do it. And if you do things positively, you hope that there's enough people that will go along and appreciate what you do, but you can't sit there and if you put your toe in the water, it's not going to work. You have to jump in. If you believe in something, believe in it and go for it. And if you don't believe in it, then don't. If you only semi believe in it, then don't do it. Do something you really believe in.
Just a last, a couple of very, very brief questions. One is that you've, over the last 30-odd years, since you really took control of your own career and your own work, you've encouraged a great many young writers and invested a bit of confidence in them. Which of them are you most pleased and proud of?
Writers that are...
Well, no, people on both sides. I was just wondering about the cameraman that you brought in. You've almost worked entirely with, what, three cinematographers over this year, with mm-hmm. Bruce Surtees and Jack Green working with him, mm-hmm. and then now is it Jack Stern?
Tom Stern. Yeah.
To take over. And, well, there's Cimino, there's Haggis, other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I try to encourage everybody. And if I find a good piece of material, if it's written by Joe Blow instead of a name, it's good material regardless. I don't have to, it doesn't have to have a great name attached. I've had a lot of projects where people brought it to me, where people had a lot of cachet, they had a lot of things going from their past, but I didn't like the material, so you just go on. I remember once I had Orson Welles call me and asked me to go to lunch with him, and that was an experience. But it was fun. It was sort of historical in my mind. I sat and had lunch with him, and he told me that we philosophized on movies and what have you. And I thought he was a fascinating character, and I thought he had this script that he wanted to do. He wanted me to play the lead in it, and he would play a smaller part and direct it. And I thought, after I finished, I said, boy, I'd love this to be a really good script. This would be kind of a fun experience. And I went home thinking, geez, wouldn't this be great if this was a good script? But I read it and it was nothing. I mean, it was nothing for me. So I just called him up and I said, you know, Orson, I just thank you for letting me look at this, but this is just not where I see myself going right now, and I appreciate it. And he just went, oh, I understand. He was just shooting a shot out there, and I guess he thought because I was at it as an actor, and this was some years back, that they could finance it and what have you. But, you know, you sometimes get dreams of nostalgia, and maybe somebody will feel that way about me someday, but where you say, wouldn't you love to put this together and for the sake of nostalgia? But it has to be good regardless of what it is. And if it's good, then it's good, you know, regardless of what your time and grade is, whether you've been in the business for 50 years or 4 years, it can work either way.
You spoke a couple of minutes ago about your age. How did you feel just as you were about to embark on this fantastic project with both the budgets, the locations, large, the complicated of scripts? How did you feel at that point about the physical toll and the challenge of it?
No problem. I felt fine. I felt I have I was in good physical condition, and mainly mental condition is that I had the advantage of a lot of years of experience, and if I can't put it together, then I should be not doing it.
I mean, Sidney Pollack once said that the first quality a director must have when embarking on a film is just that he has the physical resilience to see through the project.
Yes, I think he's right. You have to feel confident. If you don't feel confident, then you're going to be hesitant and you'll be defensive and there'll be a lot of things working against you. But you have to have confidence that you can do it. And then there's always I always joke about this, and I've probably said it before, but so stop me if it becomes redundancy. But there's a some point in every story. In my career as a director, there's always been some point where you get halfway through it or three quarters of the way through it, and you go, what is this thing all about, and why am I telling this story? You know, you kind of go, does anybody really care about seeing this? And at that time, you have to say, okay, take this out of your mind, forget that, and just go ahead. What were your first impressions? All of the things that you remember when you fell in love with the project, and continue on. Put your head down and continue on. And then, that's the way it is. You can never look back. And I don't have that now. I had that maybe 15, 20 years ago. I would get that moment, you know, just a reflective moment. It would just come and pass real quickly. But now I know it's going to be there, so I don't pay any attention to it. If there's a little bird talking, you just say, get out.
What are the war movies? What are the war movies that you've most admired in the past that have influenced or have possibly influenced you, and you would most like the two new films to be compared with or compared with favorably?
I can't say, I can't answer what I'd like them to be compared with, because I'd like them to be not compared with anything. I'd like...
Or thought as good of.
I'd like them to be on their own.
Yeah.
Films I liked were always obscure little films. I liked A Walk in the Sun. I always liked that kind of a film. I remember that fondly, though I haven't revisited that in a long time. I like Sam Fuller's Steel Helmet a lot with Gene Evans. I like, you know, Ted Post did Go Tell the Spartans. Interesting. he wanted me to do that, and he still complains that I should have done it, but he got Burt Lancaster. What do you want? I mean, it was okay. It was my loss, maybe not to do it. There were others. I haven't seen All Quiet on the Western Front in many, many years, so I don't know what that's about.
Which, of course, is also directed by Lewis Milestone, who did Walk in the Sun.
Did Walk in the Sun, yes. But, I haven't seen that one, so, but I probably would have looked at it if I thought about it, because it was telling a German point of view, so there's maybe a certain similarity, but I don't recall the story being that similar.
Did you look at any of the Japanese films, like Fires on the Plain?
Which one?
Fires on the Plain. It's a four-hour... Japanese film about World War II, or the Burmese harp.
I didn't see that. No. I didn't see that. I was mostly an aficionado, young like everyone was, of Akira Kurosawa, and that led me into Yojimbo and to remake Yojimbo, and so I give him a lot of credit for my career, or my admiration for him as a director led me into the career I had with Leone and beyond. So, you know, circumstances, the wheel goes around.
One line question, really, which is that, you know, if you were walking past the National Film Archives and it was burning down, you could just rush in and pick out one film that you had no connection with and one film that you were in or directed to put under each arm. Which films would you choose?
I'd probably grab three of them. I'd probably grab the Oxbow Incident, Bill Wellman's Oxbow Incident. I'd probably grab Grapes of Wrath, the John Ford, Steinbeck, and maybe Treasure of Sierra Madre.
But which of your own films would you? If you were impelled to pick one of them?
It's tough to say on my own. I probably wouldn't. I'd probably be like the Irishman in the bar, you know. I'd say, I don't know. You've heard that one about the Irishman, the Irish bar is burning down? Is an Irish bar burning down, and the firemen come rushing down, and they put it all out with water, and they squirt it all down, and they run inside, and there's smoke and flames, and they got the hoses out, and there's a guy standing there, and he's all in flames and smoke, and they squirt him down like that, and they say, McGindy, what are you doing in here? He says, well, they've been fire and all. And they said, well, what happened? How did it start? And he says, I don't know. It was burning when I walked in here.
Thank you very much.
Guardian Unlimited.